Hi, everyone. Welcome. I'm Dr. Maggie Ray here from Creating Positive Futures Coaching, where we help high school and college students develop the time management, organization, and study skills they need to thrive. And what we find with so many of our students is that college is such a huge source of stress for them and for their families. And so that's why I'm really excited to be hosting this Your Teen Ready for College conference again this year to connect with you all with some of the top experts in education and parenting and test admissions and psychology who can share strategies that will help set you all up for success and help navigate this college process with a lot less stress along the way. So I know in particular for a lot of students, test taking, those big standardized tests, the SAT and the ACT, are a huge source of stress and anxiety. If you're talking about stress in the college process, this is one of the big sources of it. And so that's why I'm really glad to have Jada Appleruth here to talk with us today about helping students with anxiety or ADHD or all these maximize their scores on the SAT or the ACT, even if they don't feel like they're great test takers. And this is not just for kids who have some extenuating circumstance going on that makes testing hard for them. I think for any student, when you are excited about a college and you have your heart set on getting into a particular school and you know you have to hit a certain test score to do it, there's just a lot of stress in that process. There's a lot of pressure to do well and to perform well. And so it's really important to understand how to approach that with your A game. And Jed is an expert at helping students do that. He's the founder of Appleruth Tutoring. And I think one of the things that sets you all apart as a company is just your ability to integrate that educational psychology part of your background, Jed, into the work that you do. You talk about students' mindset. You help students figure out kind of their unique angle to taking the test and approaching it in a way that's going to work for them. For those of you all who are watching who don't know, I used to be a tutor with Jed way back when, and that was one of the things I just loved about your all's materials was just the way that you presented things in this very approachable format that students could remember and retain and also help shift their mindset about the test and not just learn the content. It's just so refreshing, and not all tutoring companies do that. So, and it totally makes sense because you've got your counseling background, you've got your, you know, that PhD in educational psychology and all that expertise that you bring to the table, plus, you know, not to mention the 18 years of working with students. So yeah. You're just really the perfect person to talk about this. So thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Totally.
Great. Well, I'm curious to learn a little bit more about maybe some out of the box ways that students could approach the tests if these tests are stressing them out. And one of the things that's come up recently is these test optional schools. So maybe a kid who's so stressed out and anxious, they just say, okay, forget it. I don't want to take the test at all. I just want to avoid this thing. Can I just apply to test optional schools? Is that realistic, or are there too few schools out there that are test optional for that really to be a viable option?
So there are definitely students we work with and, you know, for other subjects, helping them with academics, testing, who decide to go purely to test optional schools. And part of it, you're limiting the range and scope of schools you can apply to. And in most cases, you know, a lot of the flagship state schools, which are going to have, you know, the best financial offerings, are going to often, most cases, require a test score. And so the test optional movement has been growing. And it's, you know, started off like there are, you know, some 800 schools on that list. And now we're seeing more schools like University of Chicago. We're seeing some better schools, Wake Forest, who are entering the mix. But in my experience, and part of it is this, that even the schools who are test optional themselves are not test blind in any way. And if you have, if you can post a good test score, you know, there's a much broader testing lane for the students who have good grades, rigor, and test scores, and a much smaller lane for students who apply without test scores, even for schools like Wake, roughly 9 in 10 students who are accepted have a test score. The same thing at, you know, the majority of schools were test optional. It's, you know, it's 10-15% of students get in without test scores, but typically they're not saying we're done with testing. Simply, and there are certain schools for whom if you don't have a test score, it's going to be very challenging, if not impossible, to get merit-based financial aid. There are many, many schools who allocate their aid based on GPA rigor and test scores. And so those who are looking for a good deal in college, you know, the merit awards are very substantial and quite important for a lot of kids. So I think it to me, test optional is, you know, for sure, it's going to be a pathway for some kids who have, you know, extreme challenges. But in my experience, so many kids, you know, can find a way to get a score that'll put them in a competitive place for so many colleges. And before you say, we're just hopping out of the game. We're not going to do testing. I think it's worth applying some energy and effort to see if I actually can overcome this hurdle. Because for so many kids as well, the next academic hurdle, there'll be a GRE, there'll be a GMAT and LSAT. And the idea of I'm just going to hop off the testing, I mean, unless you're going to be the bachelor's degree and finished, and in this economy, education is more important than it's ever been. And people are reskilling, they're going back for advanced degrees at a level that's, without precedent in our history. So my sense is, if you can find a way to turn this into a mastery learning experience versus a, I'm just not going to play this game, I think it'll actually be a benefit in your life and on later educational opportunities down the road.
That's a great way to look at it, actually, is more as a ability to hone that test-taking skill or to improve your abilities as a critical thinker, whatever all those skills are that go into test-taking, even your mindset, rather than just saying, okay, well, I'm not going to play this game because I'm not good at it. It almost makes me think of, do you have a growth mindset about test-taking?
Exactly.
Or do you have a fixed mindset about test-taking? Well, and I think a lot of kids have a fixed mindset about test-taking. They just think, okay, well, I'm a bad test-taker. Like, test-taking's never been my thing. I don't know how to do it. I've never been good at it. And the SAT and the ACT are sort of the worst of those because there's no way to study for it. It's just a test of what you know and what you don't. And I'm just not a good test taker, so I give up. So how do you combat that if a student has that kind of a fixed mindset?
We have to address it head on and talk about it and pick it apart and find examples that are contrary to the experience where students can come with a overgeneralized black and white view. You know, this binary, I'm either good at taking tests or I'm not. And part of it, I help explain to them that, you know, test anxiety, having some anxiety, fear about performance is quite normal. There's been some research that in high school, 61% of students experience test anxiety some of the time, that's 6 in 10. And then 1 in 4 students experience it almost all the time. So you aren't alone by having some anxiety and fear about assessments. But part of it throughout your life, you've had to deal with tests of some sort. I mean, the SAT and the ACT, they're not singular. We have testing all the way through with end of course testing. We have AP exams. And the SAT and ACT, I guess, they are the highest stakes test that many of these kids will have taken in their lives because they actually count and they affect outcomes for admissions, for scholarships, and other things like that. So they count. But there are going to be other assessments in your life where the stakes are a little bit higher. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, having finished my counseling degree, then I was facing this National Counseling Certified Test. And so again, even after I finish my academic work, there's going to be an assessment. And many times throughout our careers, we're going to have a test or some assessment of some sort, which will count. And we're going to have to find a way to prepare ourselves, get ready emotionally, mentally for the assessment, bring our A game. And so if a student comes and says, you know, that black and white, I'm just not a good test taker. I'm going to first start to do a query and, you know, let's actually explore. Has there ever been a time on a test that you've had success? And I'm tracking for any mastery events in their past. Because what happens when you have a black and white belief like that, you tend to, idea of confirmation bias, that we tend to confirm things which, you know, things that go in line with our thesis, we attend to them and lock into them and they're very important. And things which, you know, disconfirm, which go against it, we tend to ignore and we tend to downplay. And so, and often what happens, so my idea is I'm a bad test taker. That's a big idea. And so things that go against it, I reject. And so my thing is we're mining your past history. Has there ever been a test that you didn't totally fail? And has there ever been an assessment where you had some success? And let's talk about that. And what did you do for that test? And what happened? And what was it about? What was it like? What was your experience? And I start to have them think more critically versus this monolithic I can and can't. Because obviously that is flawed thinking. That's pretty sloppy thinking of, you know, this binary thing. And also throughout your history, there have been many smaller assessments that you obviously had to prepare for, go in there, take it, counted, and you did okay. So it ultimately, in your mind, you could be elevating this test to a different level, but it's not a different, you know, different category. It's simply a different context. But if you've had success in the past academically with assessments and tests, then we can bring the same skills you applied there to here. And to your point, let's do a mindset shift, a cognitive shift versus, you know, because ultimately, if you're a student and taking, you know, exams and APs and, you know, you have to perform with pressure and learn things and recall them on, you know, within a time condition, this isn't that different. And so a lot of the intimidation, the fear, it really is an internal thing. And a lot of it is self-talk in a script that you're running. Mm-hmm. And that self-talk, that idea you're carrying, is changing your behaviors. It's changing, you know, when you're your cognitive flexibility, your creativity. It changes your resilience. When you see a hard problem, do I persevere, try something else, or do I give up and collapse? And if you have the idea of I'm a bad test taker, that idea, which is a self-efficacy statement, is going to totally shift the way you approach, how effective you are, and when you give up. Versus someone who has a belief, I'm a good test taker, they're going to hit a challenge, a hard thing, and they're going to double down. They're going to try something else. They're going to look, try to shift perspective and say, can I solve this? I'm good at this. And so the exact same students, you know, they have the same level of ability, but one of them has this idea of I'm good at this when I'm bad at this, and that totally changes the outcome. So we're going to be working and hammering away at chiseling away that idea of I'm a bad test taker. And every time, if they're working with us, that we have some success, stop the press, everything, let's redirect all your attention to that moment of success, and let's process that, and let's make you attend to it, and make you focus on it, and make you articulate what happened, why was it, you know, why did you achieve this outcome, and what specific skills did you bring that were effective? Mm-hmm. And I'm not gonna let you write it off with, I got lucky. Like, no, none of this. What did you do specifically to achieve this outcome, and how can we repeat it in the future? So I make them become, you know, more, again, more critical evaluation, more thinking, mm-hmm. and more trying to attend to what's working and why. And little by little, they're shifting their belief from I'm bad at this to I can do this. And this applies also to I'm bad at math. This mm-hmm. also applies to I'm bad at science. I'm not a science person.
Right.
Language, I have a hard time memorizing. Because again, we're just, and whatever happened in the past, part of it, your past is totally colored by the filters you had that were bringing in certain information and turning out certain information. And so I want to kind of drop the filters and in the moment, in the middle of this thing, make that a teaching moment when you have some success. Those mastery events are critical for shifting that mindset.
Yeah, I love that, because it's not only changing what sounds like it's really becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, where a student goes in saying, I'm a bad test taker, and then they become a bad test taker.
There because... you go. And if you're fighting for your limitations, now you have them. There you are.
Right. There you go. You won. Congratulations. So you're helping them shift that, which is so powerful. And I think what's really amazing about this process you're describing of those tutors really honing in on, let's pause, stop the press, we've got to focus on the success and help you notice it. You're almost reprogramming their brain to become more optimistic, to become more just convinced in their own ability to change their outcomes through effort and through practice, which is back to, again, that whole growth mindset. And you have to have that. I mean, like you were talking about today, education is so essential in the job market. Your job is going to change. I mean, your whole industry is going to probably change. Even if you're going to college for a particular thing, if you don't have that mindset that I can learn anything if I put my mind to it, your skills are going to be rapidly out of date. So really, I feel like a lot of people approach this whole test-taking process as sort of this useless exercise. Let me go prepare for this useless SAT that's going to get me into college, and that's it. But the way that you're describing it, I really feel like it's almost character skills training for students.
Yeah, it's learning to learn. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, allowing yourself to overcome obstacles. Because we come in, and to me, it is broader than just this one context of getting into college. It really is this thing of we all come into the world and we develop at some point some self-limiting beliefs. And part of it is, do you want to carry those? And how long do you want to carry that? You know, carry that water. How long do you want to have that be a limiting factor in your life and have it truncate and limit your choices? Because suddenly there are 2,500 schools, but if it's, I have this belief of I can't take tests, I have now suddenly massively narrowed the schools that I can go to. I may not be able to go to the one that's a great deal, or really, you know, going to Georgia Tech or UGA, they all need test scores. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, and then for graduate school, for do I want to apply to, you know, go get my MBA, or like, well, there's a GMAT in front of me, or there's, you know, there's some other assessment versus, well, I just can't take tests, I just can't go that path. I want people to have as many choices as they possibly can. And when you have, you know, when you carry these limiting beliefs and reinforce them, they are going to just, you know, limit your experience, and they're going to shift your life in a way that makes you smaller, and it diminishes you essentially. So whenever someone comes with a, you know, limiting belief, I want to blow it up. I want them to, you know, experience their potential, the fullness of possibilities arrayed before them, which if some, you know, say I can't, I've heard it. I'm an artist. I love to paint. And again, and again, and again, you hear people, I can't draw. I can't paint. Mm-hmm. And they're fighting for these beliefs. I've seen, like, in my art class, the same thing. I had a teacher, and people came in, like, I can't draw a stick figure. But then when you go back to it, every single human being starts off drawing stick figures. And it's right. Just, do we want to stick with it? Does it give us pleasure? Are we, you know, is it reinforcing, or is we got some negative critical stuff of, you know, you're bad at this, and then you put it away for 40 years. And the same as I've seen people go through, like, art classes, going from stick figures to learning shading to making beautiful work. And again, and blowing out the idea of, I can't do this. The same thing with math. People come in as, I just can't, my brain's not built for math. It's like, well, if we're having this conversation, you know, if you have this logical, you can learn math. Mm-hmm. There may be, it's not, there's a balance point of there's less pleasure for me here. And oftentimes there's less pleasure, less dopamine, you know, there's less interest. But part of it, interest is often tied to our efficacy beliefs. If I believe I'm going to have a good outcome here, I'm more interested versus if I'm concerned about failure, oh, I don't like that. And I try to tease out and pick apart the distinctions there of inherently there's less pleasure for me here versus, you know, I'm scared I'm going to have a bad outcome and therefore I'm not going to like this as a means of protecting my ego and myself. But ultimately, in my experience, the majority of students, we can all improve and many can get quite good at areas that before they just said, I'm not built for this. If we shift and, you know, awaken potentials in them. And again, it always comes from going back to the basics and building blocks. The smallest successes, we focus on them as we shift that sense of who I am and what I'm capable of. But, you know, it starts at very small, but it's amazing. Again, you have like the first experience, it's positive or negative. And then you just, you know, you can decide I'm good at this or bad at this. And the whole Carol Dweck's worth of the mindset, it's I can learn this. And even if my first experience and ultimately failures are actually powerfully helpful to work with and learn from of, okay, you applied this strategy, how did it work out? Then what do we have to change? And again, it's that sense of studying your strategy. What did you use? How'd you do it? Was it effective? If not, let's shift it. And that is the growth mindset. And that is something you can bring to everything in your life. Every single problem, I can learn how to do this. And even if my father wasn't a good mechanic, but then I can still learn. I'm not limited genetically. It's because I watched my father break the toilet one time. It's like, and then from then on, he hired people. It's like, no, you know what? I'm watching other folks fixing things and learning some mechanics and stuff. If they can do this, I can do this. Mm-hmm. And it's not, I'm limited somehow. Even if a parent or a sibling, you know, I see them struggle, doesn't mean that innately there's something that's flawed inside of me. That I can learn. And so I think you and I both bring the sense of, you know, we can learn things and we can impart that to our students, that ultimately learning is not blocked off from us. And for sure, how we're built, we're going to have more facility with certain things that are visual. I have a really robust visual cortex. So things with patterns and visual things I can get quickly. Other things will take me a little bit longer, but we can all improve our processes at every single area of learning. And so it's helping teach kids that, to open up, again, to learn optimism and, you know, things that are permanent, pervasive, and personal. Like, I'm bad at math, which is always in all contexts, you know, learn optimism, Marty Seligman. It's let's blow up all those things that are permanent and pervasive, you know, versus context-based. So, you know, you had a bad test. Let's examine the context. How much did you study? How long? In what, you know, and what can we change versus just I'm bad at chemistry or math or test taking? Let's blow up those permanent big ideas and get more specific, more focused, more contextual.
Yeah, and I think in the process of doing that, just helping students shift out of that limiting mindset of I'm not a good test taker, you're going to take away naturally a lot of the anxiety that comes along with the test taking process. And I also find a lot of students saying, not necessarily that I'm bad at test taking, although that's a huge one for so many students. So I'm really glad we addressed that. And I'll hear other students say, I get so much test anxiety. I do badly because I get so anxious. And yeah. So I was curious about that. First of all, how true is that belief that you do badly when you're anxious, or can you still do well even if you're anxious? And if it is impacting performance, how do we help students address that if maybe they've got this sense of fear that's at this point just kind of programmed into their brain? They show up on a test and they're just hit with this sense of just a very visceral fear. It's not something that they realize they're even thinking. It just happens sort of automatically. How do you help them work through that so that they can actually do well?
And there is a curve. There is a great, the Yerkes-Dodson curve of arousal and stress level and performance. And what's interesting is on the very lowest level of the curve, when there's no anxiety, there's lower performance. When there's no arousal, then it's like, you know, if things don't count, you don't really bring to bear your full skill set. If like, ah, whatever, I'm not concerned about the outcome. Then on the far side, when there's way too much stress and arousal, and like that's when the performance gets trashed. There's a sweet spot right in the middle, which is the optimal level. You have enough stress to know it matters, and this actually counts, and I have to be attentive and focused, but not so much. So that's the point of, they call it eustress, where it's just the right amount of stress. And for students, it really varies. Some of them come and say, I was a nervous wreck. Then they get their test back and they got a 97, mm-hmm. you know? And so, right. And that is, you know, the idea of, you know, the anxiety in that case is actually adaptive, and it's helpful and it's contributing to their performance. And again, they're on that curve where the arousal level is not so much as pushing them into you know, the K of their performance. And everyone's different. Some people, they are very clear that I experience anxiety, but I get good scores. In that case, okay, we can work with it, because obviously it's not comfortable for you, but you're still achieving performance. Then there are students, we've worked with them before, where there is a lot of stress and it totally tanks. Like they don't show up and it's overwhelming to their system. And in that case, we have to ratchet back that anxiety, because here it's really a problem. And part of it, there's some evidence in terms of what's happening when you have so much anxiety. And there's a thing, there are a couple things happening. On one level, it's cognitive, and it's called cognitive obstruction, where you have these negative thoughts, which can become flooding. And it's, you know, I'm going to fail, oh God, and you can imagine the outcomes. And suddenly, you aren't focusing on the task at hand, and you're flooded with all these other thoughts. And for students, and that can be so, you know, crippling that now there's not enough energy, you know, mentally, my working memory is now overtaken, overrun by off-task thoughts. And there is some research that, you know, up to 40% of your thinking can be based on, oh God, I'm screwing up, which isn't really great for helping this problem at hand. And so that, those, in those cases, let's shift the thinking, the self-talk, let's kind of, you know, adjust that. And also there's a thing, neurochemically, there's some research and evidence with anxiety that there's a spike of stress hormone, and you need some. Again, when there's naturally people who are taking a test have a spike in the catecholamines in their cortisol levels. You know, you need some spike in the you know, the hormones which say this matters, focus, so you can, you know, inhibit distractions and attend. So a little bit of cortisol is great, but the problem is when there's way too much, right? You know, when it's just dumping, and then it's, you get into fight or flight. And it's not, this matters, now it's, oh God, now it's becomes a threat. And it goes from opportunity to threat, and suddenly it's, all you see is danger, and your systems are, you know, your heart rate, everything starts shifting in terms of your pulse, your pupil dilation, your skin tension, everything gets ready for a fight. Because we have the same system of addressing fear as we did when we were, you know, a million years ago running from animals. It's the same, like we're ready for, the big muscle groups are flooded with bloodstream, our stomachs, you know, lose blood flow, so we feel kind of funny. It's an old system of how do we attend to threats. And so in this case, you know, we have to learn how to way to inhibit and bring down, you know, that the stress hormone. And so much of it is, it's all an inside job, because it's a thought, you know, that's, this is a threat, I should be afraid, that's creating both the physical symptoms, the neurochemical changes, the cognitive changes, and it's all an inside job. And so when you have students who are really having issues, and I've had kids, you know, leave tests crying. And I've had kids just collapse and it's just like, I'm just failing here, and walk, you know, either just turn off or it's, now it's over, and give up. And that, those, the big things are fight, you know, flight, freeze, or fold. I've had kids leave, flee. I've had kids collapse. I guess the better one is to fight, you know, cognitively fight. But so much of this, there are many, many things we can do without throwing medication or molecules to help bring down the adrenaline system. We can, because again, and this is a huge thing to me, that the, one of the biggest gifts is teaching students how to self-regulate when they have anxiety, because they're going to be facing stressful situations their entire lives. Academically, when they go in for a job interview, when they go to give a speech, when they go, you know, to perform anything. And so much of this has to do with, are there other ways you've learned to bring down your stress or arousal before a big sporting event, before you go in front of a debate stage? Like, what do you do? And how can we bring to bear those skills? Let me talk to them about doing some deep breathing exercises. Because when you do the deep diaphragmatic breathing, it stimulates the vagus nerve, which really you know, shuts down the sympathetic nervous system. All the, you know, when you're doing deep breathing, it affects and changes and brings down the heart rate, the respiration rate, all these things, and even the stress levels. So doing the deep breathing, doing the changes to your self-talk, and learning to, you know, find, doing some thought replacement, a little bit of cognitive behavioral stuff. And additionally, you know, there's some quick intervention of doing about a 10-minute writing exercise of writing about anxiety and learning, because you're trying to get them from the amygdala, the fear center where I'm identifying a threat, to the frontal cortex, which is able to, you know, send some GABA back to the amygdala and calm it down and inhibit some of the stress. And the frontal cortex can say, you know, it's going to be okay. We've prepared. And it can calm down the amygdala. There's this nice loop that gets more developed as we get older, where mm-hmm. we're able to bring down our anxiety. We feel the anxiety, it's there. And then we're able to use our internal, you know, mechanisms to calm ourselves down, getting back to center. And so all, you know, so much of their work is helping students learn, how do I get back to center? How do I, when there's a spike in fear and, you know, this threat perception, how do I calm myself back down? And this is a profound life skill. And doing, you know, mindfulness training, observing the thinking, learning, you know, and again, with breathing, with tensing your muscles, relaxing your muscles, closing your eyes. How do I get myself back to center? I'm holding a little crystal thing here. There are times before big speeches, if I'm giving a lecture, I'll have a thing in my hand and I'll hold it as a little thing of trying to center myself. Right now it's kind mm-hmm. of something to play with. But in the grand scheme, there are so many ways people learn how to calm themselves down. And this, you know, is no different. And there's also a great technique. I love this one that I learned in cross-country practice years and years ago, where the coach would have us close our eyes for 10 minutes and he would guide us through, after practice, before a big meet, he'd have us imagine ourselves going through every single step of the race. How we're feeling, you know, we pass someone, what's happening with our body, and you begin to lay down this mental track, a new neural pathway of yourself performing at this level in the midst of a stressful condition of a race. And I do that with kids, academically, having them close their eyes, having them learn how to make a neural pathway, a mental walkthrough of this test, how you're doing, you miss one, how do you feel, take a breath. And so you're beginning to replace any old prior stressful memories with this new neural pathway, this new memory you're trying to ingrain. So when they come to this test, they actually have another example they can pull from of mm-hmm. them. Okay, I missed a problem and it's okay. And you begin to work your self-talk of, you know what? It's only one problem. We're okay. Onward and upward. Because the self-talk is really a huge part of it. If you sustain anxiety or short-circuit it. And if you're feeding yourself thoughts of, oh God, it's over. And now mm-hmm. it's downhill from here. That's going to, you know, perpetuate and increase versus missed one. Let's keep focusing. We're doing great. You've worked hard. Let's go. And that inner messaging, the self-talk is huge. And that ultimately is the main skill we're trying to cultivate, the ability to bring ourselves back to center with our inner languaging, our self-talk. So that's why I say it's an inside job. I mean, there's breathing, but self-talk and combining all these things together allows people to learn how to calm themselves and ground themselves when they're stressed.
Right, right. Well, and it's great that you're also talking about pulling in skills from other contexts, like you were talking about with the cross country, and then you're pulling that visualization exercise from cross country into maybe a test taking environment, because probably a lot of these kids have some context in their life where they can handle pressure. And I mean, not all of them, maybe some of them, they're going to need to lay down these skills for the first time ever because they've always had a hard time under pressure, but they may have a sport where they're doing great and they have certain coping strategies that they use under these high stakes performance-based situations in that context of their life. And all the strategies that you just talked about, the muscle tension and relaxing, the breathing, the visualizing, all of that sounds like stuff they could really practice in the months leading up to the test, because that's you right. all are going to be working, tutoring them leading up to the test. They could be working on that beforehand so that it's not like they're getting in on the day of the test trying to sort it out. Oh my gosh, how do I self-regulate? How do I figure this out? And trying to manage it in the moment. It's almost like the skills for test taking. Except it's the skills for self-regulation that need to go along with the skills for test taking, and they're practicing both along the way based on how you described it. That sounds
right. And it's not all Eastern. For some people, it's going to be hard exercise. Mm. Really helps them ground their anxiety. I know people in my life, you know, who for them, if they don't exercise and they run, then their mental health is affected dramatically. And also sleep. Mm-hmm. Obviously there's a diet exercise, the trifecta, but getting those right can also help dramatically. the mental health that we have, and for everything, for anxiety, for depression, for addiction, for, you get those right, you know, sleep, exercise, and diet, and it affects every system. So that's also, you know, doing a quick self-care checkup on the students, because and for some it's going to be, you know, they have to run hard, and then they're just calm internally after they get that, because when you run, it's endorphin, it's serotonin, it's dopamine, it's all the good stuff, and that helps, you know, counter the cortisol. And so there are many ways in, and this, you know, really is in the context of how do you overcome any skill? How do you manage, you know, how, because we're all going to have performance things in our life. There's no way not to, whether it's giving a speech at your friend's wedding or whatever, it's going to be something where there's stress. Right. How do I perform at my optimal? I was reading this book called Daring Greatly last night.
Oh, it's so good.
Mm-hmm. It's so good. And, you know, Brown and her speech at her TED talk on vulnerability. And, you know, we're going to have to at some point put ourselves out there, and we're going to have some stress. And how do we, you know, get ourselves centered that we're going to have to show up in our lives? And I think this is, to me, this is not just a little thing of test taking. This is a major, a hugely transferable life skill. Self-regulation is the key to like everything. Right. So we're giving them a little bit of it in this moment of how do you self-regulate? Because you'll need this everywhere throughout your life.
Oh, that's so true. So true. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think the whole college process really in a way is if you approach it the right way. Some people approach it completely the wrong way, as we've seen with the whole recent college admissions scandal. There's all sorts of reasons why some people approach it the completely wrong way. But if you approach it the right way, with this test prep, with how you're going about with the self-exploration that goes with writing your essays, when you're trying to become the best possible student you can be at school, get engaged in extracurriculars, all these different pieces of the college process that I feel like are really serving the student's growth as a human being, not just their ability to get into a particular school or something like that. If people are thinking about it in this way that's so narrow, and if we just broaden that picture, the SAT and the ACT take on this whole new meaning. So, well, that's and cool. before we totally lose track, because I could just talk with you for like a day and still learn new things. I want to make sure we get into that whole SAT versus ACT, especially for students who have any sort of LDs, or maybe they have ADHD, or they have something going on that's going to maybe make testing a little bit harder for them. They've maybe gotten over this self-limiting belief of, I'm just not a good test taker. I can't do this. I opt out. Forget it. Yeah. So we've gotten them past that. And then we've gotten them to the point where they can regulate their anxiety enough to focus on the test.
Yeah.
I'm wondering about the test format itself, in terms of the SAT versus the ACT. What might predispose a student to take one versus the other? And also, how do we approach accommodations through all of this to make sure the students have the best testing environment for them?
Yeah, so a lot of our students who have learning differences, they tend, in many cases, to go towards the ACT for a number of reasons. Because the ACT, the biggest challenge on the ACT is more timing. And in many cases, students who have diagnosed disabilities are going to be able to get extra time on the ACT. And that really solves for the timing issue. And that helps them dramatically. So the SAT has a much higher reading level. It's about 3 grade levels higher. Hmm. So we're seeing, you know, more advanced texts, vocabulary. And so a lot of students, if, you know, if they have dyslexia, other things, the lower level reading on the ACT is really quite helpful. And so that's, you know, that's the shift that I've seen over time. In terms of, you know, getting accommodations, you have to apply early. Ideally, you're applying for them for the PSAT or for the pre-ACT, so there's plenty of time. And then you do all the prep, all of the focus with the accommodations, you know, as the foundation. If you have time and a half, everything you do is, you know, just time and a half. So you're learning how to work with the time I'm allotted. If you have some other accommodation, whether it's a quiet room or whether it's, you know, large font, whatever you're working with, let's try to, you know, recreate those conditions in our practice sessions. But ultimately it's not all students. Again, it's a heuristic that typically I see more LD kids going to the ACT, but there are many, you know, who find their way and they succeed very, you know, at a very high level on the SAT. So one of the most important things is we have to do a dual baseline. I want to do a practice test for pretty much every single kid who comes to us. Hmm. And if they know they're going to have the accommodation, then let's use it with that and see how do you do with, you know, time and a half on the SAT versus ACT. Because they're also a little bit different. Like the SAT, the math is more like reading-based math, and it's not as advanced, the mathematics on the SAT. The ACT has more advanced math, and for some kids, math is their issue. And the bigger focus on algebra and functions, that's going to be more comfortable, and word problems for a kid on the SAT. And there's, you know, less trig, there's less advanced math, you know, all over. Additionally, with the science fluency, there's a lot more science and actual science assessed on the ACT, and there's less of that on the SAT. And so for these reasons, you know, students are going to have, you know, more or less abilities on one test or the other. Some kids are on the range of indifference where it doesn't matter, in which case I defer to their preference. But before I do anything, I want to give them a test of each, and I want to see where they land and see where they're stronger, whether they have a disability or not, before we start any prep at all. Because it's impossible for me to tell just based on your, you know, here's, I'm bringing this, I'm good at this, I'm a reader here. I can make a guess, but I can also be wrong. And to me, I want to get rid of the guesswork. Right. And so let's spend a few hours on, you know, a couple Saturdays, or let's use your PSAT as a proxy. Mm-hmm. Let's have a comparison before I throw you into any kind of preparation. Because some kids, you know, they're 100 points off. And so I could waste 10 hours on one area where you would have started off just here if we just started there on this test. And so we just kind of blew that time and resource. And so that's the beauty of doing baseline testing. Really important, I think, for this work.
Yeah, and that's a great point. And we're kind of leaving this without really saying it, but we're treating it as an assumption, and I just want to make it very plain to people who are watching. We're kind of operating under the assumption you're going to prep for one or the other. You're not necessarily going to prep for both. Because I do hear still, surprisingly enough, from some students who say, well, my school makes me take both, so I'm just going to prepare for both. I'm going to do this whole prep process for both of them. And I'm curious your thoughts on that, because it seems like from our description, I mean, I know my preference, but It seems like from our description here, we're talking about take both and see which one
then go.
You do better on, and then go with that one.
That's right.
So is that kind of a myth that you need to do both always?
It is totally a myth. I mean, the tests overlap roughly 80%. Okay. That's so 4/5 of the work will transfer, but that 20% difference is a very profound difference in this, in the world where the difference between, you know, 1,300 and 14, you know, that's a small difference, but it can make a huge change on where you're accepted. And if you get into an honors program or scholarships, you know, so to me, it's much more efficient to, once we identify what's where you're stronger or where's there a natural preference, let's put all of our attention and energy in that basket. And the only time I ever go back and shift is if you're in the range of indifference where you're within 70 points on the SAT scale, like you have a 1200 SAT and a 26 ACT. Okay, you're roughly the same. Then I'll defer to student preference and we'll start prepping. And if after two baseline tests, things aren't moving, then I'll say, you know what? Why don't we go back and try the other one? Because again, we've been prepping for a time. And when you're prepping for one, you are de facto prepping for the other. Again, it's about 8/10 transfers. So let me see if, for whatever reason, we're making gains on this one. But if a student is prepping, then they do practice tests and they're making progress, we don't look back. You know, because you're applying an intervention, you're doing work, and it's showing a return. But let's keep going with that. And again, not have to worry about the distinct timing and the very challenging timing of the ACT, the higher level reading. Like, because part of it is, if we're shifting for the SAT, then I'm not worrying about the timing stuff on the science section. I'm not worrying. I don't want to, you know, burden them and shift them away from, you know, their focus. Because if we really channel our attention, our energy, I can use that leverage and get a higher return on one test. And then if it's more diffuse and I'm spreading out our time and resources to two tests. So I really want to have a, you know, once we identify this as our test, let's go full on. Every area of weakness you have, let's address it. Let's correct it. Let's have you have your very, very best. And then we're blowing the other one away. Like, once we're really zoning in on the nuances of SAT reading, on the nuances of the SAT, you know, the way they present math questions. Mm-hmm. So I can focus your attention, which to me is more effective, more efficient.
Totally makes sense to me. And I know you mentioned at the beginning, those test optional schools, they still do sometimes prefer, especially for merit aid, for students to be submitting test scores. And there is an advantage to submitting, even though the schools say that they're optional. Is there any advantage at all to students submitting an SAT and an ACT, or is that just basically that it makes no difference?
I've not heard from a single admissions office in the country that said we are going to give a preference to students who submit both. There was an article, now it's like 5 years old, there's someone from I think NYU or there was somewhere in the New York Times where they're like, you know, we love all testing, if you have more, send it, we'll take it. But it was, they definitely didn't say we're going to give a preference and we're going to give an advantage in admissions to kids to take two. What they want is, do you have the score we need, either on the SAT or the ACT? And You know, it's, we're not going to give it, if you get a 35 and a 1500, I mean, it's just, it's more confirmation, but by the merits of you already have this test, okay, then essentially at that point, testing is checked. Testing is great. And so hitting it, hitting more testing, okay. So there's, that's not going to compensate for a weaker essay. That's not going to compensate for weaker activities or, you know, or teacher recs. Testing will take you so far, and testing for the various selective schools will get you into the conversation, but it doesn't push you into the accept pile. Testing is one part of it. And so it's simply, it's like a filter. When they have, things have never been so selective at the top. The top 100 schools, all of them are driving lower and lower acceptance rates. So testing is simply one more, it's like a funnel in process of how do we go from, you know, 40,000 applications and choose a class of 2,000. Well, testing is one, you know, one mechanism to kind of get you closer. And then it does become holistic, essentially the review process in terms of your activities, your recs, your grades, your rigor, all these things, it all factors in. But testing alone is not going to push you into the, now you're coming to this selective school. It gets you into the conversation, essentially. Or if your scores aren't in that band they're looking for, it keeps you out of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So it's like, testing is like a hurdle. You know, GPA and testing and rigor, that's like a gateway. And then, okay, what else do you bring in terms of activities, in terms of personality, in terms of, you know, self-awareness, in terms of what kind of person are you going to be on campus after we assess, can you hack our academics? Are you going to be able to survive and thrive and get out of here in 4 years or 6 years, which we're graded on in terms of our rankings? Because we want to make sure, first and foremost, academically, you have the chops to hang out here and not transfer out or fail out. Yeah.
Right. Completely makes sense. Well, so it really does seem like at some point you've done enough prep to get over that hurdle. If you keep sinking more and more and more time into that process, you're doing it at the expense of those other things, like working on your essays or developing those relationships with your teachers or something along those lines. So it does make sense to, you do your test prep process and then you're done. And getting over that hurdle, getting over that hurdle, I know can be tough, but we talked about some strategies to help with that. And I know the accommodation, having the right accommodations set up, if you are a student who has the need for them, can be a really big difference maker as well. And I'll hear sometimes from families who've maybe waited too long to apply. They didn't think it through. They've already signed up for their test. And it's past the point where they can really get the accommodations. And it's such a shame because the student really does need them, but they don't have them in place. So when should families be starting to think about that timeline of applying for those accommodations to make sure that they don't end up in that situation?
As early as possible is the answer.
Is there a too early or no?
Ideally, like with the College Board, once you get your SSD, like your number with a disabilities number, that stays with you through everything. That'll stay with you through your AP exams. That'll stay with you. So I want to get that ideally for the PSAT. So well before they're talking about the SAT, I want to find out, are they going to grant me accommodations? Here's my IEP, my 504. Mm-hmm. Here's my proof of accommodations in my high school. I want to get that number. Once you have it, it's yours. The same thing with
the sophomore year or?
Oh yeah. Sophomore year is great. You can even get it for, you know, that's perfectly, that's great. Cause then, you know what you're going to get from the College Board. If they, if they're going to honor the, you know, your accommodations in high school and your disability. And so in a similar fashion for the ACT, ideally I'm going to find out some kids, their schools offer the pre-ACT. You can get it for that. And then if you're given it for that, you can, you know, reapply for, and it's much, much easier getting it for every future test. Some students do a fake testing administration for the ACT where they're going to sign up and they're going to just to see what they're going to get. So like they're going to sign up very early. It could be you sign up for the July ACT, you know, before you're a junior and you haven't finished all your preparation yet, but then you're going to find out because you have to apply for a test. I'm applying for accommodations on a given test for the ACT. So I could be applying for that July ACT to see, will they accept it? Are they going to honor the accommodation? If not, they may come back and say, we need more information. And I want to find out earlier versus waiting until it's critical. And typically, you know, they want to see 4 months of accommodation in high school. And do I already have that? Or they may want, you know, more teacher statements, more information about the way in which you're using accommodations in school before they grant the accommodation. So they're, you know, end of sophomore year is great. You know, applying that's perfect, or very early junior year. Beyond that, it starts getting stressful. Right. And the likelihood of you not getting what you need in time increases. So my thing is early, think early, and find out, because again, some kids, they're going to have to appeal if they aren't accepting the first pass, and they want full documentation. They want, and it may be they don't have recent testing and they want more testing. And these things take time to go and talk to a counselor, get a psych evaluation, which takes time and money. So I want to find out very early on what they're going to do. So there, yeah, I would say end of sophomore, summer before, early junior, that's a great time, because waiting until late junior, it's just, as you know, we've seen this, when then the level of stress goes way up, and then early senior, it's like, you kind of missed the boat on this thing. So
at that point, it's just too late. Well, and I'm thinking too, families who are in maybe even going into fall of sophomore year, would it be, because at some point they may just say, well, you're too soon. You can't sign up for your PSAT accommodations at this point. You're a freshman. You're an eighth grader. I mean, at some point there's a too early.
But sophomore year is great.
Anytime is fine.
The sophomore year PSAT mm-hmm. is perfect. So I can get my time and a half set up for that, or the pre-ACT, or I sign up for, you know, end of sophomore year ACT, totally fine. Mm-hmm. Even if, you know, you're going to defer that administration till later, that's great. Spend the money, change you'll find out where you stand. And that's
now. So you can sign up and then you can push the test date. They could grant you the accommodations, and you could say, thanks for the accommodations, and I'm not going to use it here. I'm going to use them later. So you don't have to actually take the test.
No, you can say, thank you. Yeah. It's mm-hmm. like a ghost, you know, administration, which you use to determine what they're going to do. That's totally fine. Totally appropriate. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great to know, because that way you don't have to have your test date for sure picked out and your whole prep schedule planned out.
Even before you do a minute of prep, you sign up for administration and then find out, because that'll affect how you prep. If I'm going to prep with time and a half conditions, I got to first find out, will they actually give that to me? Mm-hmm. And if they say no, we're not going to give you those, well, then I have to prep accordingly or appeal and find out what else they need. That to me is a best practice to get an accommodation, to find out even before you're, you know, looking at taking a test. That to me is great.
That completely makes sense. And it's such a good way of thinking about it that it might not occur to you if you weren't thinking this through. So I'm really glad you shared that tip with us, because definitely something now I'm going to encourage all our families to do. This has been so helpful. Thank you, Jed, for taking the time to talk with us today and to share all these ideas. I know also we've talked a little bit about comparing SAT and ACT scores. And for families who want to follow up with you all for more information, we're going to post a link right below this interview for anybody who's watching to the college admissions testing guide that AppleRuth has created, which is a really great resource. It's all about, you know, the test scores and the GPAs and the class ranks of all of the accepted students at a number of colleges and universities across the country. So you can kind of look and see, okay, I'm thinking I want to get into this kind of a school. What score range am I looking at? Maybe I can compare that to my PSAT scores to see how far I have to go. Yeah. You can look at your concordance tables of SAT versus ACT and say, oh, okay, I scored a this on my SAT. What would I need to get on an ACT to tell me that that's the better test for me versus not the better test for me? So just all that information is going to be there. There are lots of additional tips there as well about PSATs and SATs and how to approach the test taking process and secure accommodation. So it's really full of great information, and definitely check that out. Whether you have a student with LDs or ADHD or any other accommodations or not, it's still got really great information in there, and you'll definitely want to get a copy of it. So it's right below our interview. Just click that link to go over to Apple Rooster website and get a copy of it. And then if you all have been watching today and you want to share this with a friend, share it with maybe a family you know who has a kid who's getting close to their test prep, or a parent you know who's been stressing out about test prep and the fact that their kid is not a good test taker, maybe you could share this interview with them, because we do really want to help make sure that as many families as possible get access to this information. So the replay will be up for 48 hours. Please feel free to share the link with anyone that you know who might benefit. And if you want to keep a copy of it forever, we have that option for you all as well. Just go to your Teen Ready for college.com/event, and you can grab a copy of the whole interview series, all the recordings, all the transcripts, everything that's included, so that you can keep it forever. If you've got multiple kids going through the process, you want to refresh on this, or maybe you're a super proactive parent and your child is not yet in sophomore year, even close, and they're going to be going in as a freshman, and you want to hang on to this. These things don't really change in terms of the SAT versus the ACT, the self-regulation processes, how you apply for accommodations, all of those things are going to be pretty constant. So if you want to hang on to it as a reminder, you can get a copy and keep it forever. So thank you again, Jed, for joining us. This has been such a pleasure and so much fun. Yeah. I always learn from you every time. So thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you soon.